Let's get into the Word together this evening. We will be in 1 Kings chapters 3 and 4. 1 Kings 3 and 4. You know, Jesus said that you need to come to Him like a child. He took one of the little ones and He stood him in front of Him and He said, "Come like one of these, for of such is the kingdom." It was an odd thing for him to say because in those days, children were considered essentially a sort of miniature adults that weren't quite cutting it. They didn't have what we call youth. They didn't have an emphasis on understanding youth as we know it today. And so children were very often considered sort of second-class citizens. It's changed now because we have a culture that practically worships youth. But in those days, children were considered disenfranchised, not worthy, and so on, until they reached a certain point in society and were able to contribute in certain ways. But it's an interesting thing about children. They know who they are, generally. And whatever else you might say about them, they can be brutally honest about themselves and about everybody else. And they're also quite simple in terms of faith. In other words, if someone they trust tells them something, they will buy in right now, and they'll believe. And it was that about them that Jesus was referring to when he says you have to come like children. He wanted people young enough to say, "I am willing to trust you, and I'm willing to put my faith in what you've said." Because it's odd, the older we get, it seems, the less inclined we are to believe what we've been told. And that's because you get hurt in this world. There's not a lot of truth out there. But God tells the truth, and that's why he says, you've got to come to me like a child. He didn't say you go to everything else like a child. He says, come to me like a child. Why? Because he's trustworthy. Interesting how many times people start well and don't end well. They start young as a believer, and they make strong commitments, and they say the right things, and they learn early. But then as the years go by, how often the commitment slips, the wiser, quote-unquote, they get. Their wisdom in terms of adult maturity actually ends up getting in the way of the wisdom a different kind of wisdom they had when they were kids, which was a simple faith in God that they wanted simply to grow in. Well, the reason I mention all of this is because this is kind of like Solomon, and we're talking about Solomon. Solomon started well. He did not end well. And we're going to see how that works. And it is a surprise to see how many people do start well and do not end well. How many people ruin their lives late in their lives. How often people earlier in their experience with the Lord are making strong statements of faith, but then as their age increases, they put more confidence in money, more confidence in the world, less confidence in God, and their faith becomes watered down. In fact, they look down on the exuberance of youthful faith as if to say, "Well, honey, I know you love God now, but believe me, you'll get over it." After you've been beat up by life, and like I have, and so on, and you have been beat up by life, no question about it, but the Bible actually says that life will beat you up, and the only way to survive it is to actually hold on tight to God. Nevertheless, people often lose what they had early on in their lives. Solomon is like that, and we're going to see his story in the weeks to come as we travel through these first few chapters of 1 Kings. But he started very, very well, and this is where the really positive lessons from Solomon's life are to be found. It's in these first chapters. We're in chapters 3 and 4 of 1 Kings, and what the year that he began to reign actually began to reign alone was 970. There was a co-reign with his father, David, for a few years, possibly as many as five. But he began to reign alone when his father died, and that was in 970 BC. And he reigned for 40 years. He had a long, prosperous reign. At least it was prosperous from the standpoint of the kingdom. David had been a warrior. He had lived on beans in the field. He ran for his life, and he defended his life, and he defended the life of Israel all through his life. He was a warrior. He was a dangerous man. He knew what it was like to camp out. in the wilderness for weeks and months and years. Very tough, very resilient, very strong. Not a particularly outstanding administrator, not a particularly outstanding diplomat. His diplomacy was done at the end of a spear. The army was his tool of diplomacy. But that was the way he was supposed to be. God called him to be that way. When he took over, Israel was surrounded by enemies. They were all trying to kill him. David's job was to defend Israel. Solomon is very much the opposite in terms of character, in terms of everything. In his early years, of course, very much like his father in his faith. But the very, very opposite in terms of the kind of guy he was. You don't see Solomon. There's no pictures of Solomon killing anybody like Goliath. There's no pictures of Solomon killing anybody. Solomon was born and raised at court, where he was relatively well taken care of and respected. He was trained and grew in diplomacy. He was the kind of guy who saw the international scene, and he built the nation because of that. And the Lord gifted him to do a completely different job than David. They were both excellent kings, each in their way. They both failed late in their life, by the way, each in their own way. Solomon's failure, I think, worse than David's, for reasons we'll see when we get there. But they were very, very different men, and they each had their own contribution to make to the kingdom of God. When David's job was finished, God called Solomon to do what he wanted him to do. Solomon means peaceful, and the Lord had said, he told David, I will have a man after you, one of your sons, who will be a man of peace, and he will build my temple. And that's exactly what Solomon was called to do. We'll see how he enters into that project and some of the other things that enter in as well at the time. But very different men. Solomon, a smooth man from the inside of the palace. David, a rough guy from the outside. Solomon, a diplomat. David, a warrior. Solomon, a man whose wisdom kind of got in his way late in his life. David, a man whose lust got in his way late in his life. People think that Solomon was lusty too, just because he had 1,000 women. We'll talk about that. But actually, it wasn't that. It was his idolatry. And there's a reason why he fell into idolatry, and it wasn't really just about women. We'll see as we go. So I want you to see the contrasts, and we'll make some of them as we go along. But these early years, these first 5 years, basically, after David died, were the best in Solomon's life. And the reason is very simple. It's because he saw himself as a young man who needed God's help. When he outgrew that is when he really started to get into trouble. So would that we all saw ourselves, no matter how old we are, as young people who need God's help. Solomon, by the time we pick up chapter 3, Solomon had not been a bloodthirsty man, but he did have to execute a couple guys. And he did not get rid of all of his rivals to the throne, as other people would have. Some kings, when they took over, literally had every other possible king executed immediately. That is not what Solomon did. He did have Adonijah executed because Adonijah had made a play for the harem, and that meant a play for the throne. He had him executed. He had Joab executed for reasons that David had told him to. He had Shimei executed eventually, and if you missed out on those and you'd like to know about how these guys got killed, you can pick that up in the tape from last week, if you are bloodthirsty, actually. Chapter 3, not really. It's an interesting story, but I'll let you pick it up. At the point we pick up chapter 3, he's consolidated his power. He's firmly on the throne at this point. And so what we find in chapters 3 and 4 is his initial relationship with God and how God begins to bless him in it. Beginning in chapter 3, verse 1, then Solomon formed a marriage alliance with Pharaoh, king of Egypt. And he took Pharaoh's daughter and brought her to the city of David. It's interesting because the city of David was always called the city of David, not the city of Solomon. Isn't that interesting? It's a synonym for Jerusalem, but it also refers to the small area in a portion of Jerusalem that was once the citadel. Well, it actually still was the citadel, much smaller than the larger city. And it was where David's palace was, and of course, which his palace was nothing compared to what Solomon had on the architectural drawing board for himself. But this is where he brought this bride that he took from Egypt, to the city of David, to this rather small area, the citadel, in the middle of Jerusalem, until he had finished building his own house and the house of the Lord and the wall around Jerusalem. Now the people were still sacrificing on the high places because there was no house built for the name of the Lord in those days. This, of course, was before Solomon built the temple. They did not have a temple. People sometimes think because of David's commitment to the Lord that he must have had a temple or something, but that's not it. If you know the story, there was no temple. He had the ark by itself in Jerusalem and a small altar that was something of a duplicate of the larger one that Moses had, and that was all David had in Jerusalem. There was no main temple. Now, having read those two verses, does anything strike you as kind of unusual? Let me ask you this, as you think about it. Would David have married an Egyptian princess? Can you feature David marrying anybody outside the covenant? But Solomon was a different kind of man. Solomon began very early to marry women outside the covenant. And his reason was not because he loved them. I know later it says he loved many foreign women, but it's not the kind of love we normally think of. This kind of love was political. It was a political connection. The way to consolidate your power was either conquer the nation next to you or marry the daughter of the king, because that made a family connection. Everything had to do with these strong family connections. So if you wanted to have a political alliance, you married somebody close to the king. And if that, by giving you his daughter in marriage, he was saying, I promise to be friends with you and I won't tear your land up and I won't be a threat on this border. Because of course, my daughter is married to you. And so I'm not gonna cause you any trouble. And this actually was a functional way. I mean, when you think about it, it makes sense. And the nature of relationships is such that if there's a vested interest across the border, because you have a family member over there, everybody feels a little bit safer about everything. Now, Solomon knew that. It was very well-established political reasoning behind all these marriages. When you hear that Solomon married so many women, understand it was not just an insatiable desire for more women. Many of these were political alliances that he made in order to retain peace with these other nations. Now, the fact that he married an Egyptian princess is very unusual because the Egyptians did not usually do this. Reason? They didn't usually have to. They didn't need to buy peace with anybody. They were huge, powerful, mechanized, very, very wealthy nation at this time. And they did not have to marry off princesses in order to make peace with neighboring kingdoms. They just said, you either get along with us or we'll come in and tear your heart out. That was their way of dealing with things. The fact that the Egyptians would send a princess to Solomon tells you something. It tells you that Solomon's kingdom, which had been given to him by David, was powerful and had to be dealt with. And it also tells you that the Egyptians did not want to have war, all-out war. Although they had some skirmishes, they didn't want an all-out war with Israel. That tells you that Egypt wasn't all as strong as they were at other times, and Israel was very strong. And during this time of Solomon's reign, the other surrounding kingdoms, the Hittites and so on, and the Egyptians, were all in a sort of abeyance. They were not as powerful as they were at other times. So the Lord had created a peaceful time for Solomon. And he retains the peace by making an alliance in a marriage. Now, it's interesting because the Lord doesn't rebuke him for this. And there's several things in this chapter that you will look at and say, no, wait a minute, what meaneth this? And the Lord doesn't really say very much about it. So watch what happens, and we can actually learn a little bit. So anyway, he marries this, and this becomes a pattern for him, marrying and intermarrying with the kings. And notice, too, that they are sacrificing on the high places. Did that strike anybody as odd? Now, David was a godly king, and he is the standard of the godly king. He had enforced the Torah. So what are the high places? What is this worshiping in the high places business? High places were simply elevated territories, little hills, and upon the top of a hill, they build a little altar to worship. Some of them they used to worship Yahweh because there was not a central location for the tabernacle. The tabernacle was in two pieces. One was up in Gibeon, where there was a high place, one of the most important ones. That's where the tabernacle was. That's where the great altar that Moses had built was, and the laver probably, all that stuff that he had done. That was up at Gibeah, about 7 miles, or Gibeon, about 7 miles north of Jerusalem. The rest of the kit was in Jerusalem, where the ark was. So you had the ark in Jerusalem, and you had the tabernacle up in Gibeon, and this is all during David's time. Why is that? That is far from ideal. Solomon fixes it. Why didn't David fix it? Because God wouldn't let him build a temple. And he wanted the ark with him. And there was no room in this little town, the city of David, to put the tabernacle and everything else. So he left it up there at Gibeon. This was one of the high places. Some of the high places were used to worship Yahweh. Most of them were pagan, however. And after the tabernacle is built, you watch as you read Kings, every time the high places are mentioned after that, they are ridiculed and looked down upon by the authors. Because once the temple is built by Solomon, the high places are supposed to go away. But until then, you have this far from perfect situation that God seems to be putting up with. I want you to see that that's actually, there's something to learn from that. So they're up there at the high, people were still sacrificing at the high places during David's time, because there was no temple. Solomon loved the Lord, verse 3, walking in the statutes of his father David, except that he sacrificed and burnt incense on the high places. What? Now, wait a minute. Solomon did this too? Yeah, he did. He would go to one of the local outside the tabernacle places and worship God. That's very un-Torah. I mean, that is not done. And that's why it says, except he did this. He loved the Lord, but he just never could quite kick this habit of the high place thing. Now, once the temple was built, Solomon stuck with the temple. But I want you to know something. If you know something about Solomon, you know that idolatry crept into his life later in his life. And I wonder if early on there was not a weakness here that he never really dealt with. Because even the author says he loved the Lord, but there was this area. It is not a perfect situation. It is not an idyllic thing. Verse 4, and the king went to Gibeon, about 7 miles north, to sacrifice there. For there was a great high place, and Solomon offered 1,000 burnt offerings on that altar. When it says great, it means important and large. And some of these high places, by the way, were very ornate and well-appointed. And this was one of them. We don't know from 1 Kings, it's from Chronicles, that we know that the actual tabernacle was up there and that that's where this could be done. He went up there and he offered 1,000 burnt offerings on that altar, which was the original altar from Moses. The original altar from Moses was about 7 feet by 7 feet and about 4 feet tall. And the one that David had down in Jerusalem that he used, that in conjunction with the ark, was somewhat smaller than that. And so Solomon did not stay down with the ark. He went up to Gibeon, where the other one was, and he worshiped up there. But it was notice that the Lord did not rebuke him for this, because it really was Moses' tabernacle, and his heart was right with God. He loved the Lord. And if you're going to make 1,000 sacrifices and you're going to invite several thousand people to be there, it's very difficult to do that in the tiny little place of Jerusalem at the time. So he went up to this big high place where the tabernacle material was, and he did it up there. And the Lord came and met him there. Do you ever wonder how much junk the Lord has to get through just in order to meet us? In terms of stuff that's far from ideal, that really is not in line with his word, that really is not in line with what, if you were to say, well, Lord, is this right about this over here and that over there? And sometimes he'll just brush it aside and say, well, listen, they're my rules, and I will simply deal with you where you are right now. It is amazing how often he does. It's not that his rules don't matter. But when the heart is right, God will go to any extent. He will say, we will just bypass this and this and this and this and cut the red tape. And we'll go straight to the heart of it and I'll meet you. That is an amazing thing. That is a good thing. He doesn't let red tape get in the way with regard to his relationship with humans. Now, once you come to him, he says, now I'm teaching you how to deal with who I am and what I say. But when you first come to him, it is amazing what he will wade through in terms of human foolishness to get to you. And he does that. There's a lot of stuff that's not really exactly right here, but Solomon's heart is right. He is David's son. He wants to worship God. He's about 20 years old, and he's been handed this kingdom. And he says, well, I'm going to take 1,000 critters up there and slaughter them as a sacrifice to God. That was a huge sacrifice. Remember, Solomon did not have a wealthy, he did not inherit a wealthy court. He built a wealthy court, but he didn't inherit one. So he makes a huge investment to go up there and sacrifice all these animals. Animals were cash, by the way, in those days. They were cash in that society. So this is a huge investment. And it, at Gibeon, verse 5, even though it was a high place, even though the ark was down in Jerusalem, at Gibeon the Lord appeared to Solomon in a dream at night. And he said, ask me what I should give you. Have you ever fantasized maybe about what if the Lord, the angel of the Lord, came to you and said, hi, what would you like? It's like a genie, you know. What would you say? What would you say? Honest and truly. Now, don't say, well, I'm in church. I'm bless me spiritually. I want you to answer honestly. What did you ask for today? Today, when you were praying before you knew this Bible study was going to happen, and you said, Lord, I got to have, fill in the blank. What was it you asked for? Honestly, if the Lord came and said, what do you want? Even though we know the story, we know how to answer, because if you know the story, you know how to answer. I wonder if, in real honesty, we would answer as wisely as Solomon did. But for a 20-year-old guy who'd just been handed a kingdom, he has the perfect request. Solomon said, you've shown great kindness to your servant David, my father, according as he walked before you in truth and righteousness and uprightness of heart toward you. And you've reserved for him this great loving kindness, chesed, that Hebrew word, very important concept, covenant love. You have kept your covenant with him, Lord, so that you have given him a son to sit on his throne as it is this day. There's a lot of theology here. What Solomon is saying is, I know I'm here because of a fulfillment to my father, a promise to my father from 2 Samuel 7, the Davidic covenant. Solomon is showing that David must have trained, if he didn't train all of his sons in godliness, but he must have done something with Solomon. Because in this prayer, Solomon prays and he says, you have been faithful to my father David. And it's almost as if, you know, you're working for a company and the owner of the company, you've got a supervisor who's you've worked under all these years, and the owner's been real good to the supervisor. Now the supervisor dies, and the owner brings you into the supervisory position. So now this is your first meeting with him, and it's kind of like, I know you've been really good to my predecessor. And you almost have this sense that it's not as personal as you might hope. It's more like a kind of an official thing. Like, it's not real devotional. Even though it's a vision where he's talking directly to God, it's a little bit official. I know you've been faithful to my father David. I'm letting you know that I understand that I'm here because of a covenant you made to him. Verse 7, now, O Lord, my God. Aha. So a transition has been made. Now I know you are my Lord too. By the way, it's a great moment when a young person realizes that they have a personal relationship with God that is not connected to their parents, even though they learned it from their parents. There's a point at which you're saying, God is the God of my parents, and another point at which you're saying, you are my God. Solomon made the transition. You've made your servant king in place of my father David, and I am but a little child, na'ar, means a kid unable to support himself, young enough not to be able to support himself. I am but a child. I do not know how to go out or come in, which is an idiom that they used. It's just a way of saying, I don't know what I'm doing here. I have no idea what I'm doing. I just killed 1,000 animals, and I know how to do that, and I know how to pray, but I really have no idea what I'm doing. Interesting, because he was very decisive with Adonijah, with Joab, with Shimei. He could have said, you know, for a young guy, I'm not doing all that bad, am I? He could have thought that, but that's, see, he was overwhelmed with what was in front of him. And it's amazing how when you're overwhelmed with what's in front of you, it's easy to fall on your knees. And we spend all of our time saying, Lord, don't bring anything in front of me that will overwhelm me. And he's saying, yeah, but I need you on your knees because that's where all wisdom is found. Yeah, but don't overwhelm me. Well, you see, you can't have it both ways. So he's overwhelmed now. He says, I'm a kid. I have no idea what I'm doing, Lord. And your servant is in the midst, verse 8, of your people, which you have chosen, a great people who cannot be numbered or counted for multitude. These are your people, Lord, and I don't know what I'm doing with them, and I have no idea what to do with them. Notice what he's saying. Your plans are what matter. Your hand has brought me here. I am not up to the task. Only you are, implied. And your people are important to me, not my prestige. These are all the keys in understanding how to serve God. Your plans are more important than mine. You're the one who's put me here. I have no idea what I'm doing. And if I am able to do this, it will be because of a miracle you've done. And I just hope to handle the miracle with increasing skill as time goes by. That's all. But I'm never going to mistake my wisdom for yours. It has to be from you. And your people are more important than my prestige. The job is more important than who I am. Awesome leadership lessons there in terms of spiritual leadership. So here's what he prays for. Give your servant an understanding heart to judge your people, to know the difference between good and evil, right and wrong is in the NIV, to tell the difference between right and wrong. Because who is able to judge this great people of yours? Part of the king's job was to be able to lay down laws and policies and sometimes personally arbitrate very, very goofed up situations that require supernatural wisdom, really, to deal with. And one of them we'll see in a minute. And he's saying, I can't do this. Lord, you've got to give me wisdom for your people. Give me what I need to serve them well. The Hebrew, therefore, understanding heart means a listening or obedient heart. And he means listening to you, Lord. A heart that's open to hear and obedient. They're both from the same root, by the way. In Greek and Greek and Hebrew, listen and obey are both very, very close etymologically, to hear and to obey. And that's what he's asking for, a heart like that. Give me an understanding heart, one that can hear you, Lord, to know right from wrong, which sometimes isn't always easy, is it? It's not always easy to tell right from wrong. And to judge the people well, shafat, judge, means to make it the way it ought to be, to make a decision that actually moves the whole situation to the way it ought to be in God's eyes. And that's easier said than done. And the proof of it is that lots of people complain about getting involved with law and order, and very few people actually do it. Because it's easier to complain about justice than it is to administer it. It's easier to say, well, judges are all making wrong decisions than it is to actually be called into the judgment seat and have people's lives resting on your decision and have to make the right decision. And this is a 20-year-old kid whose people's lives are at stake here, and he says, Lord, I need your wisdom to do this. I'm not going to be able to do it. So it's the perfect prayer, and the Lord is pleased with it. He doesn't ask for any of the stuff normally that a young guy would say, I've got to have power, I've got to win wars, I'd like a few extra women if you've got any, and so on. He doesn't ask for any of that. Verse 10, it was pleasing in the sight of the Lord that Solomon had asked this thing. And God said to him, because you have asked this thing and have not asked for yourself long life, nor have asked riches for yourself, nor have asked for the life of your enemies, but you've asked for yourself discernment and understanding, to understand justice, to know the difference between right and wrong, and to be able to convey that. Behold, I have done according to your words. I have given you a wise and discerning heart, so that there is no one like you before you, nor shall anyone arise after you like you. And I have also given you what you have not asked, both riches and honor, so that there will not be any among the kings like you in all your days. And that's exactly what happened. He blessed him with all of these things because Solomon came to him without his heart on any of it. And the Lord said, then I'll give it to you, as long as your heart's not on it. And so people read this and they go, wow, that's the way to get all that stuff. Cool. okay, Lord, give me wisdom. Of course, it doesn't exactly work that way, does it? This is a prayer that, as soon as I heard about this prayer, which was 30 years ago, when I first started to study the Word, a young guy who was also a minister spoke to my heart, and he said, make this your prayer if you want to serve the Lord in this world. And you know something? I have made it my prayer. And I'm not a wealthy man by any means. I don't have all of the stuff. But I hope and pray that in anything God calls me to, there'll be enough wisdom there to accomplish something for Him. And I encourage you to make it a prayer. In whatever it is you do, wherever God calls you, to say, Lord, forget about the prestige, forget about the other stuff, and give me whatever I need to represent you well wherever you call me. Make it a prayer. It is a perfectly legitimate prayer and a good life prayer. So the Lord says, I will bless you. Verse 14. Now notice He says, if you walk in my ways and keep my statutes and commandments as your father David walked, then I will also prolong your days. He says, I'll give you these other things, and if you keep walking with me, I'll let you live longer. I'll let you have a long life. He had a medium long life. And in the end of it, he really wasn't walking all that well with the Lord, if you remember. So it was like, okay, that's as far as he can go. Verse 15, Solomon awoke, and behold, it was a dream. And he came to Jerusalem and stood before the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord. Now he's back in Jerusalem, and he offered burnt offerings there, and he made peace offerings and made a feast for all of his servants. Now, what happens in from now to the end of chapter 4 is how God answers the prayer. And you'll see four areas. Personal insight, that's the one with the two hookers. We'll see how that goes. Civil administration, yeah, they are. They're hookers. Civil administrative skill, chapter 4, verses 1 to 20. He's really an outstanding administrator. Ample provision, verses 21 to 28 of chapter 4. The Lord just gives what he needs and more than enough. He has a very, very well-fed court. And wide knowledge, verses 29 to 34 of chapter 4. Watch how the Lord answers these prayers. Solomon says, I'm not just giving you my heart. I am praying for a discerning heart so that I can serve you in wherever you call me to be what you've called me to be, the kind of wisdom I need to do what you want me to do. That's what I'm asking for so that I can represent you. And the Lord says, I'll give you this and this and this on top of all of that. And here's how it works out. First is the most famous story from the Solomon stories is the story of the two women and the baby. Two women who were harlots came to the king and stood before him. You know, the first time I ever heard this story, I did not know that they were streetwalkers. I didn't know they were hookers. I thought these were just two ladies who were roomies and, you know, one of them had a baby. Does it strike you as odd that the wisdom of God should be offered in a situation where we're talking about harlots here? Watch. One woman said, oh my Lord, this woman and I live in the same house, and I gave birth to a child while she was in the house. And it happened on the third day after I gave birth, this woman also gave birth to a child, and we were together, and there was no stranger in the house, just the two of us. And this woman's son died in the night because she rolled over on him. Isn't that terrible? And she arose in the middle of the night and took my son from my side while your maidservant was sleeping. She calls herself while your maidservant. She's not really describing her job description exactly. While I was asleep and laid him in her bosom and laid her dead son next to me. And I rose in the morning to nurse my son and he was dead. Then I looked at him carefully in the morning and behold, he wasn't my son. And the other woman said, no. The living one is my son. The dead one is your son. The first woman said, no, the dead one is your son. The living one is my son. And they had a big fight right there in front of Solomon. Now you can see how this would get to Solomon because the really tough cases all went up the ladder until it finally got here to him. So here's these two hookers arguing about this, about whose baby is who. And Solomon, this is the kind of dilemma you get into. Now, we know the end of the story. We read the story. We think about, you know, the wisdom God gives him. And forget that for just a minute. Before you get to the end, because you're not in the end of your story, are you? Okay? You're not in the end of the dilemma you're facing. So think in terms of before the end of this dilemma here. Isn't it interesting that the Lord purposely faces us with dilemmas and forces us to make hard decisions? And forces us to say, well, Lord, I don't know exactly what to do. I desperately need your wisdom. What can I do? You know, you guys, sometimes as a pastor, I have been called into situations that there was literally no way I could possibly have been emotionally or spiritually prepared to give any of the answers that were necessary in the situation. No way. And I can tell you, even though at times I felt very inept and still do sometimes, I feel like I hadn't said what needed to be said or hadn't done it as well as I should have, and sometimes I'll debrief later and say, if I have a chance to do that again with somebody, I'm going to do it in a better way. I can tell you this from personal experience. When you're called by God to come into a situation that you had no way of understanding ahead of time, and it's a dilemma, the Lord will use your faith and he will give you what you need. It may not be as dramatic as this, where everybody goes, oh, wow, what wisdom. It may not be like that. But you can trust that God will use you. And you can also trust that you'll be in these. There'll be dilemmas in life that will force you to make decisions that you'll go back to from time to time, and you'll say, Lord, I've committed it to you, and I did the best I could under the situation. God's wisdom will be there. Anyway, so this is the thing. Now, another odd thing here. Do you ever wonder why Solomon didn't say, well, why are we talking to harlots in the first place? Why are you doing this in the first place? This is not an honorable profession. And how am I being called in to bring justice to two women involved in a profession that is so radically ungodly? Aside from the fact that it was extremely common, really common in that culture, even among the Israelis, far from perfect society, even under David. But you know what? Sometimes you have to make the right decision amidst a whole bunch of other wrong ones. And you might say to yourself, well, it's really unfair that I should have to make this decision because I wouldn't even be here. Right? We would not be dealing with this if you had... And it's true, because if these women had not been having illegitimate babies, the whole situation would have never happened. If everybody had been living by the Torah, then Solomon would not be here having to make this decision. But unfortunately, in real life, you don't have the luxury of copping out that way. In real life, it's messy. And you will sometimes be called upon to say, okay, forget the external circumstances. Right now, I got two people in front of me and I need to give them an answer or share something with them, or I've got a dilemma. I need to do the very best I can under these circumstances. Help me to do right, Lord. Instead of saying, well, it's just unfair. Life is imperfect. It is imperfect. And even a couple of women in this profession needed justice from the king of Israel. And the Lord gave it to him. King says, well, you know the story. He said, give me a sword. So they're both thinking, oh no. Cut the child in half. Give half to one mother and half to the other one. Simple. And you could see the eyes widening because, of course, they'd never read the story. And they never went to Sunday school and saw it with the little flannel graph, you know, with the baby that comes apart. Did you ever see that flannel graph? You know, no? I guess I must have had a kind of a sick Sunday school teacher. Well, it worked. Divide the living child in two, give half to the one and the other half to the other. And the woman whose child was the living one spoke to the king. She was deeply stirred over her son. She said, no, my lord, give her the living child. By no means, don't kill him, give him to her. But the other one said, well, yeah, go ahead, I don't care. Because I don't want anybody to have them if I can't have them. And there you have it, the difference between the real mother and the false mother. You can tell who cares about most things because they're willing to make the sacrifice. People will sacrifice for what they believe is right and what is most important to them. And that was the wisdom that God gave Solomon. It was personal insight to bring about justice. Now, justice, remember, is the way it ought to be. Mishpat, the way it ought to be. And that's what needed to happen. He needed to put the baby where the baby belonged. So what he did was he tested their character, realized this must be the mother, and justice was actually done. He said, give the first woman the living child and by no means kill him. She is his mother. All Israel heard this judgment, which the king had handed down, and they feared the king, for they saw that the wisdom of God was in him to administer justice. Answer to prayer number one, personal ability in interpersonal judgment to give the right answer. Chapter 4, the first 19 verses are a description of Solomon's kingdom. I'm not going to read it all. You're wondering how we're going to end on time. That's how. I will point out, however, when you read it, what you'll find is several names, and you'll find that he divided the nation up into 12 tax-paying districts, something his father had not done. And all the districts, if you check it out in the maps, you'll find that they didn't follow the tribal allotments. This ended up causing a little bit of consternation among the people. But what Solomon did was basically he appointed 12 governors, set up all of his kingdom so that he could extract tribute from them to support his government, and so that he could organize the whole thing. And this is the list of all the people that were involved in it. You say, well, why would the Lord, in his word, list all these guys? A couple of them were his sons-in-law, actually, that were involved in this, but not all of them. Why does the Lord list, through 19 verses, name after name after name after name, and just, you know, explaining this rather mundane detail? Well, there's a couple of things we can learn from it. One is, it's okay to organize. Some people think it's really terribly unspiritual to be organized. You ever notice that? Truly, truly. I mean, if you actually start on time and end on time, there's some people who think that that's really unspiritual. The only way to tell if you're spiritual is to go on and on and on and on until people are falling over, starving to death. That is the way that you can tell a real spiritual meeting happened. If it starts on time and ends on time, the Holy Spirit couldn't possibly be in charge of that. That's too organized. That's too orderly. Actually, that's not true. It's not that the Lord can't use disorganization, but disorganization is not a virtue in and of itself. He uses organizations. He forces people to get together, to flex with each other, to work under one another, to actually say, okay, this is my job, that's your job, I'll do mine, you do yours, we'll do it together. And what he does is then he uses the flexibility in that organism, in that organization, rather than having everybody just do any old thing they want all the time, never having to answer to anybody. He says, no, 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 we got to cooperate. And he uses that in the organism. The reason I say all this is because there's a kind of anxiety sometimes in the church, in the body of Christ, over the issue of functioning together as a church and having real organizational structure of any kind. And you know what, folks? A word to the wise. Just a word to the wise. It's really okay to cooperate with other people and be a part of a larger organism than just what you have going. It's really okay for you to say, well, okay, I don't have to do that. I'll do what I'm being asked to do because it'll make a contribution to the larger good. And it's a mark of wisdom to do that. So wherever you go as part of the body of Christ, when you plug into a church, and you should, realize you're plugging into something that was already there before you got there, and ask yourself, where can I help? Where can I be a part of the existing thing? And see if the Lord will draw you in. But if he does, be a part of it. One of Solomon's great geniuses was this issue of organization. And it served him well in his early years when he was walking with God. It backfired on him in his later years. But that's because he wasn't walking with God. It wasn't because organizing is always wrong. So he organizes the nation, and it really does something David never did. It consolidates the nation. All the way down through verse 20, Judah and Israel were as numerous as the sand that's on the seashore in abundance, and they were eating and drinking and rejoicing. It was a blessing for this nation to be well organized for the first time in its entire life. Verse 21. Now, for the next few verses, you'll notice the next thing. We've seen personal insight, civic administrative skill, which was a spiritual gift and a very spiritual thing for the nation at the time. It was needed. And now, ample provision, 21 to 28. Solomon ruled over the kingdoms from the river to the land of the Philistines to the border of Egypt. And they brought tribute and served Solomon all the days of his life. That's a huge kingdom for an Israeli king. All the way north to the Euphrates River and all the way south to the border of Egypt and all the way into Moab on the east and all the way to the Mediterranean Sea on the west. A huge kingdom, and I won't we don't have time to look at the map, but when you get a chance, most Bibles will have a map in the back that'll show you Solomon's kingdom. We'll talk more about it in the future, so don't fret over it right now. But it was huge. And Solomon's provision for one day was 30 cores of fine flour and 60 cores of meal. That's about 300 bushels and 600 bushels. That's for one day. That's amazing. They figure anywhere from 16 to 25,000 people were on his payroll based on what they used. 10 fat oxen, no skinny ones, 10 fat oxen, 20 pasture-fed oxen, 100 sheep besides deer, gazelles, roebucks, and fattened fowl. They had birds. For his was a dominion over everything west of the river, from the Tipsah even to Gaza, over all the kings of the West River. He had peace on all sides around him. So Judah and Israel lived in safety, every man under his vine and fig tree, from Dan to Beersheba, all the days of Solomon. He had 40,000 stalls of horses for his chariots, 12,000 horsemen. This wasn't all in the first year, but this was eventually how it turned out. That's a lot of horses. And those deputies provided for the King Solomon and all who came to King Solomon's table, each in his month. They left nothing lacking. And they also brought barley and straw for the horses and swift steeds to the place where it should be, and each according to his charge. Now, what we find is that a lot of this wealth became a very much of a snare for Solomon, because the Lord had told the kings of Israel not to multiply horses and not to multiply wives. And Solomon did both, and it cost him in the long run. But that's not the point here. The point here that the author is bringing out is God said that he would see to it that there was ample provision for Solomon's household. And there was ample provision. Solomon then used it to buy more horses, which he didn't have to do. But nevertheless, the provision was there. God comes through with his promise. Verses 29 to 34, wide knowledge. God gave Solomon wisdom and very great discernment, breadth of mind. In other words, it wasn't just a few things he knew. He knew a lot of stuff, like the sand that's on the seashore. Solomon's wisdom surpassed the wisdom of all the sons of the east and all the wisdom of Egypt. He was wiser than all the men in Ethan and the rest of those guys. In verse 32, he spoke 3,000 proverbs, and his songs were 1,005. He wrote songs. He spoke proverbs. We don't have them all. But he was legendary in literature. He also spoke of trees, from the cedar that is in Lebanon, even to the hyssop that grows on the wall. NIV, I think, renders that taught about or teaches, something to do with that. The thing is that the Hebrew word there for spoke about, they didn't realize until recently that it probably meant he actually named them. Taxonomy is naming of various genus and species of things. And he actually knew enough about botany and biology and to name and categorize lots of the trees and the animals. So when you read in Ecclesiastes that he gave his mind to various different things, he had a great mind to give to various things. He spoke also of animals, birds, creeping things, and fish. Men came from all the peoples to hear the wisdom of Solomon, from all the kings of the earth who had heard of his wisdom. We'll stop there. What can you learn from all of this? Well, a couple of things. First of all, remember that wisdom isn't just an academic discipline. It's the ability to do what you need to do when you need to do it by God's standards. That's what wisdom is. And that's what the Lord gave to him. A lot of times people think wisdom is just about knowledge. Because Solomon was so wise, he had a lot of knowledge. But his wisdom began with his walk with God. That's where it started. And that's where our wisdom has to start. It's not just an academic thing. It's not something we're learning facts about. God gave him the ability to do whatever he needed to do. Also notice this. God will use, in your wisdom and in your ministry, circumstances that are far from ideal. And he will accomplish his work in circumstances that you think to yourself, well, this is just too messy for God to work in. He's probably just going to destroy it all and start over. If you look at the stuff that Solomon dealt with when he first started, the people were using the high places to sacrifice. He was having to adjudicate between hookers. He was dealing with folks who were really not as spiritual as we all think they were under King David. And yet still in the midst of all that, God said, you give your heart to me, I will use you in this, and it will work. God uses far, far from perfect circumstances to bring about good things. Sometimes in ministry, in life, we look at the undone stuff in our life, the unmade beds, all the things that we think, you know, well, the Lord's blessing me over here, but look at this. This whole part of my life is just broken. And God can't use that. And I'm just waiting for the Lord to be the Lord of this broken stuff over here. And then when my life is really going to be on the cover of some Christian magazine, well, then everything will be fine. The fact is, it's never going to be that way. The cover of magazines is always fake. Always. They airbrush everything to sell the magazine. Nobody's life is that perfect. God uses imperfect stuff. He uses imperfect people. He uses people with scars and stuff in their background they don't want anyone else to know about. Because if he couldn't do that, he couldn't do anything with us, could he? So he uses lots of imperfect things, but he will give you wisdom for what you need if you will commit your way to him for his purposes in the midst of the mess. And I'll tell you, that keeps me going in ministry. It keeps me going. Ministry is really messy. Yeah, you're thinking to yourself, no. It's always nice and clean when I come in here. That's because invisible people come in here and clean it up and make it look good for you all the time. Now, life is messy, and God's work is in a sinful world. So take heart. Even with Solomon and all of God's blessings, the Lord had to sift through the junk that was going on in order to get it done. So take heart in it. Solomon's prayer really is simple. He says, in essence, let me do the simple realities of wisdom. I want to close with a verse that's very similar. In fact, Solomon's an illustration of the verse. Turn to Micah 6:8. It's in the Minor Prophets. Micah 6:8. Serving the Lord in a fallen world seems complex, and the dilemmas are many, and life is messy. But Solomon is a great illustration of how God can do marvelous things in a messy world with a person who will say, give me your wisdom. And in Micah 6, it makes it fairly simple, actually verses 6 to 8. He says, With what shall I come to the Lord? It's a prayer. With what shall I come to the Lord and bow myself before God on high? Shall I come to him with burnt offerings and yearling calves? Was it really the sacrifices that did it for Solomon? No, it was his heart. Does the Lord take delight in thousands of rams and 10,000 rivers of oil? Is it really about the outer details and the outer perfections? Shall I present my firstborn for my rebellious acts, the fruit of my body for the sin of my soul? Shall I make my own propitiation for what I've done? And the Lord simplifies it, whew, brings it right down in verse 8. He has told you, O man, what is good. And what does the Lord require of you? And look at this. This is exactly what Solomon said he wanted to do. To do justice, to love kindness, chesed, covenant love to God and to each other, and to walk humbly with your God. That is exactly what Solomon did. And that is what children or young people, when they realize it's this simple, they say, well, I can do that. And that's why Jesus said, come that way and stay that way, no matter how old you are. Let's bow our heads. Father, thank you for reminding us. It really is not all that complex. Our world is complex, and the dilemmas are many, and sometimes it blows our minds just how confusing our world can get. But when we just think about you, come back to your word, and are reminded to come as children, we see Solomon's illustration perfectly. Lord, would you please give us the wisdom we need to live our lives today? For the dilemmas that face us, the moral dilemmas, those who come to ask questions, those to whom we must witness and bear witness of truth and goodness, let us live out Micah 6:8 like Solomon did. We pray that you will grant this to us, Lord. And I pray for my brothers and sisters facing circumstances right now, tonight maybe, or tomorrow, in which they will desperately need your presence. May your presence be with them, Father, as they release themselves to your purposes. In Jesus' name, amen.